Yeah, but don't worry, I'll just cut out everything that we don't want.
Are you sure?
Yeah, why? Do you got something major to say?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll just say it because I think if I stop, it'll probably get screwed up.
Okay, I'm pregnant.
Oh my gosh, that is major. Oh my gosh. Rita, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, no wonder you're exhausted.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, my face is like turning red. I'm so excited.
I almost asked you to turn your video on so I could see you.
Oh, you should have. Oh my gosh, I did not see that coming just now. Whoa. Oh, I will be praying.
Thank you. That's amazing. Mainly why I wanted to tell you early for you to pray for us. I'm just I just want it to be healthy. I know I'm old. Yes. So, you know.
You're not old. You're just older.
A geriatric pregnancy. Yeah.
It's a horrible thing. It's a horrible way that they say that.
It is.
Congratulations, Rita. I mean, that announcement that we just heard, that is from weeks ago when you surprised me with this information. But we were just waiting to announce it on the podcast until you had a chance to announce it in real life. So super exciting news. Can't wait to meet this little baby. I mean, I probably won't actually physically meet the little baby.
I hope but you so know what someday.
I mean. I hope so too. I really, really, really hope so.
Well, it was a pretty firm chance of that happening, you know, mm-hmm. well, not necessarily pertaining to the baby, but us like meeting as families. But, mm-hmm. you know, with the things happening in the world, who knows?
I know.
It's unfortunate.
It's kind of been taken out of our hands, but
yeah,
hopefully it'll get put back in our hands one day soon.
Yes. But anyway, we're very excited.
That's so good. And I'm sure people are wondering like how you've been feeling and all of that. So
good. At the beginning, no, not so much. But I think just, I don't know, maybe being a little older and things, I'm a little more tired and, you know, than normal. But no, I feel great now. I'm in second trimester and I feel honestly pretty normal. Like it's a little odd how normal I feel. But with my other two, I kind of had forgotten how good I felt during pregnancy. I really enjoy it. So
that is so awesome. I can't say the same. I did not enjoy pregnancy. It wasn't a good time for me. I remember at the very beginning of yours, you did say, "I am too old for this." And I just thought that was so funny because I'm like, you are not. So, but I'm so glad that you're feeling better.
Yeah. I think really like with both the girls and this one, like I just really try to continue like exercising and things. And I think that makes the biggest difference. Like if I don't for a couple days, like I really feel it. And I feel so much better when I'm moving a good amount. You know?
Yeah, I think that's very true. Anyway, so that's the exciting news, you guys. I'm glad we got to share it with all of you. Today on the podcast, we are going to talk about Huxley versus Orwell. Basically, these two guys wrote two different books really close together, actually. So Orwell wrote a book that was dystopian. They're both kind of dystopian in nature. But they were different kinds of dystopia. And so there's a guy named Neil Postman who wrote a work called Amusing Ourselves to Death, and he kind of breaks down the differences between the two. So I'm going to read what Neil Postman has to say about these two books and the dystopian visions that they had, and then Rita and I are going to talk through them, and we're pretty excited for this. We think it's going to be an interesting conversation. Okay, so Orwell warns that we will be overcome by an externally imposed oppression. But in Huxley's vision, no big brother is required to deprive people of their autonomy, maturity, and history. As he saw it, people will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us, and Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
When you sent me that passage, I was just like, wow, I feel like that's exactly what we're living in, both sides of the spectrum. Like, I don't think one of them is right and one of them is wrong. I think they're both exactly right. And it's almost that currently I feel like we're in worst case scenario where both things are happening simultaneously. And it's just creating the biggest chaotic mess, I think, based on the fact that we're like living these comfortable lives and we're, you know, we have all this information constantly at our fingertips, just like Huxley says. And then at the same time, the information we have is so tailored to us via algorithms that we can't ever get out of the box, so to speak. And it's the censorship and all of that that Orwell's talking about and the government control. So both things are happening simultaneously. And it's just like, wow.
I know. Yeah. Like, that's why I sent it to you. It was in a different book that I was reading. And I've heard this multiple times before, this Orwell versus Huxley thing. And it's always been interesting to me, but reading it again currently in what we're going through right now, I was just like, oh my goodness. People always thought, you know, these are just, you know, science fiction type things. This will never happen anyway. But I always had an impression that something like this could happen.
Oh, yeah.
But I think a lot of people thought it would be one or the other. And so it's just super interesting that we are in this time where there's a little bit of each happening. And I've read a lot of articles about this, you know, Orwell versus Huxley thing over the past couple days. And, you know, even 2 years ago or 3 years ago, like in 2018, people were like, we're far away off from either of these things happening. However, and I'm just like, man, things have really, really changed in the past couple of years, because I would not say we're far off from this at all. I'd say we're very much in it, at least in the beginning stages.
Yeah, I was reading, actually, when I was reading up on this, there are so many, guys, if you just like search this, there are so many websites just like disputing this issue and like talking through it and thinking through what they think, who they think is right. And it's really interesting. But there was one I was reading and it was literally from like 2 years ago. And they're like, clearly we are far away from these events.
I read that
and
I'm one
like,
too.
nope, not so much. But really quick, we should probably mention, because both of them have multiple, more than one kind of dystopian novel. So they're specifically referring to Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World. These are the ones they're specifically talking about in these articles for the most part. But it is interesting that you said like people kind of thought it would be one or the other. It seems that Huxley really even, and maybe Orwell as well, but specifically the letter Huxley wrote. So Huxley was, I think Orwell's, I didn't write it down, but he was a French teacher. Yeah.
So crazy.
Yeah. And so Orwell had sent Huxley his book after he had written it. And reading one of these articles that we will link in the show notes has the full text of this letter that Huxley wrote to Orwell. And it's very interesting to read through, but he's kind of saying this is a very timely and pertinent novel, and then kind of goes on to criticize it, saying that he is right and that what Orwell's saying isn't really what's going to happen to destroy society. It's his thoughts that he had previously wrote in Brave New World. And so it's kind of interesting to see that they even thought that there were conflicting ways this was going to come about. And it turns out they were both right, and from my view.
Yeah, totally. And I'm just going to read the last little bit of what he wrote in that letter. Huxley writes, in other words, I feel that the nightmare of 1984 is destined to modulate the nightmare of a world having more resemblance to that which I imagined in Brave New World. The change will be brought about as a result of a felt need for increased efficiency. Meanwhile, of course, there may be a large-scale biological and atomic war, in which case we shall have nightmares of other and scarcely imaginable kinds. So I just find that really interesting. Like, I think we can all relate to that felt need for increased efficiency, and we definitely see that happening in the world with all the technology that we're utilizing on a daily basis.
Yeah. I kind of just refer to it as the Google society. Like,
absolutely.
Everything is just at our fingertips. Levi and I think we've talked about this on our podcast, but Levi and I talk about this all the time. It's like people don't even need to know anything anymore because it's at their fingertips. So they know so much less than people in the past. Like, think about the skills and the just common knowledge that people had, you know, in our grandparents' day and age, because they had to, because it wasn't just like at their fingertips. And so now it is, and it's just like people are, they don't learn things as they used to. They don't retain them as they used to, because they can just Google it whenever they want. And it's so interesting to me, that that's really applicable to what he's saying. And I was thinking about this year, just also how happy people are to just regurgitate the information they see without knowing where it comes from or knowing if it's true. They just hear something and regurgitate it. And personally, I've been thinking about that a lot as applied to my hospital. You know, I'll ask a question of the higher ups in management, and they just, it's literally like a newspaper headline comes out of their mouth. And it's not, they don't know why they're saying it, or they can't back any of it up. It doesn't make any sense. They just spit out the newspaper headline. And it's just very interesting to me. Like yesterday I was driving and I heard a radio ad about the shot in, you know, reducing transmission. It was a doctor, and this is going to stop transmission. I'm like, well, that's not even true if you actually look at science and you actually like read what the FDA even said. But these people are so happy to just regurgitate information they hear and not even contemplate whether it's true or not even, I guess, think about where it came from.
I just feel like because of this Google culture that we have, our brains have become less equipped to take the time to like sit down and really figure things out and think them through critically and come to our own opinion. And like, let's just even think of the way news traveled from the beginning of time until now. So like back in the day, like the day, long time ago, if you wanted to like send news, you would maybe did smoke signals, right? Because that's all you had available to communicate from tribe to tribe. And then eventually maybe you went to word of mouth, and then to telegrams and newspapers where people would have to sit for a prolonged period of time and like read through things. Then it went to radio, and then it went to like black and white TV, and then to color TV and HD, where our eyes are like consuming all of this content and it's like sending different signals in our brain. And then it went to social media and it went to streaming, and more the information became bite-sized and colorful. And I think that changes our brains. And I feel like we're so used to bite-sized content that's kind of presented in a very, what's the word I'm looking for? Like
entertaining?
Yeah. Very manner. I feel like that's a very good point. Like I feel like politics, religion, news, athletics, education, everything has been transformed into like a show business culture.
And like when you were describing those things, it, for me, it, in my mind, I'm visualizing it going from about the information communicated to about the way it's communicated and how we can grab people into the information. Like I think about people sitting around a cup of coffee 100 years ago talking about what's happening and really debating things. But now that doesn't happen. Like people don't really debate like that. They just state their case based on what they've heard. Assumed as their own opinion. And I don't know. Just so different.
I feel like we've gone from being conscious consumers of news and information and debate to being just these unconscious consumers where not only do we not necessarily have the energy to think things through, but our brains just, I would say, have devolved. You know, like we could probably, people could make an argument for evolved or devolved, but I feel like if you have less ability to concentrate, that's a, that's devolving.
Well, I think technology has evolved and humans have devolved. So I think it's like kind of as one goes up, the other goes down. So like, I think the Google Society really applies to Huxley's thought process. Whereas the other side of media and what's happening applies very much to Orwell with the censorship. Yeah, you've talked about before, you know, the book burning of today is the censorship of the internet. And just the erasure of articles. I was thinking this morning about articles that I had looked up over a year. Well, it would be almost 2 years ago now, regarding flu transmission. Mm-hmm. And it was before the COVID scenario at all. I had just looked up some articles. I was looking up, I don't remember why I was looking this up, but the articles were referring to, you know, if there were to be a greater outbreak of some virus, people's immune systems are less likely to be equipped to fight if they've been constantly exposed to the flu shot, was basically what these articles, and it was a study, it was a legitimate study. And I had saved the link in my notes on my phone. And last fall, I went to click on it. It's not there anymore. And since then, that has happened with so many things, so many different articles that were legitimate scientific articles and studies that aren't there anymore and you can't find. And so not only is censorship happening on the level of we're taking things off the internet that you can't say via social media or news and those kind of things, the misinformation, disinformation thing, but it's also happening by way of research articles being scrubbed from the internet that were at one time considered, you know, good research.
Yes.
So it's just really interesting. Go ahead, Cecily.
Yeah, I was just going to, it's short, but when the good research articles of the past don't fit the current narrative, they're scrubbed.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened in 1984. So the main character of the book works in the, I can't remember exactly what it's called, the Ministry of Truth, maybe. Mm-hmm. But anyways, he works there, and what he does is take articles in that the higher ups have sent to him and change the wording, like they remove language. So the language is being dumbed down. And then simultaneously, he's changing history to fit the narrative of today. And people just forget what even has happened. So that's very applicable. But also, one other thing I thought of with the censorship. So there's a website, the Wayback Machine, and you can like look at what websites said like last year versus this year. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking when Robert Malone came out and was talking about this shot, I feel bad that we always go back to this. It's just like, it's just the topic of the day.
And it so is. It's hard to avoid.
It's easy to find things within that
example
scenario to apply to what we're talking about. Yeah. So anyway, when he came out and started talking about things, his I don't remember if it's his Wikipedia.
Well, just bio. In case people don't know Robert Malone, he's like he was involved in the beginning stages of the mRNA research, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, his I think it was his Wikipedia bio, but it changed after he started speaking about this. And so there was a person on social media who had posted the website now, what it says about him versus what it said like 5 months ago. And it's very interesting. And so that's another form of censorship, just changing information, maybe not necessarily changing it to something untrue, but leaving out truths to discredit people.
Yeah.
So I think that's all very applicable to how Orwell thought of the situation.
So that's the Orwellian part of it. And then the Huxley part of it is just this overconsumption of entertaining information that's essentially deadening our brains. Mm-hmm. And I think what it boils down to is that these two different guys wrote two different books that are really about two different modes of the same thing, which is oppression. And in both scenarios, people become captives, they become slaves. And so it's interesting that on a civil level in our countries and whatever, people see it going in an opposite direction. And they've seen it going in that way for a really long time.
Yeah. Well, so, I think it has been going that way for a really long time. It's just all very apparent right now, which is the way things happen, right? You know, a problem starts long before it surfaces as a real problem, right? Mm-hmm. Usually.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So basically in Orwell's case, the oppression stems from something that it's an external force, right? It's the government oppressing you. And from Huxley's, it's more of that internal oppression that we inflict on ourselves, but that also is coming I guess it goes back to the elites and innocents episode, right? Where we're the innocents who are accepting this internal oppression, but it's actually influenced from somewhere above. So yes. It's just kind of interesting.
Yeah. Like I had brought up to you yesterday, we were just kind of like diving in yesterday a little bit more mm-hmm. and kind of bantering back and forth about this on Voxer a little bit, because mm-hmm. it's just so interesting to think about. And the one thing we brought up was, so in Huxley's book, there's a soma, I guess. It's like this drug.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, okay, so this is just like this year, a good example of this, like Cecily just said, there's an external construct, you know, putting these things out there and we're openly accepting them. When everything shut down and you're driving by and the liquor stores are all still open. And yeah. I'm not, you know, judging anybody for whether you have a beer or not. Absolutely not. But my point is, if you look at society over the last 10 years, how much alcohol is glorified mm-hmm. in, like we don't have cigarette commercials anymore, but there are alcohol commercials all the time on TV.
Yes.
And even like I was noticing last year watching Hallmark with my girls, mm-hmm. There never really used to be a lot of drinking in Hallmark movies. And now there is. They're always having a beer together, always having a glass of wine together, which mm-hmm. it's fine. That's neither here nor there. But the point is, it's becoming increasingly not only socially acceptable, but almost socially promoted as cool and neat. And then at the same time, when all these essential businesses are left open, liquor is considered essential because it's numbing to us. It's something that people widely accept. And it will numb them to even looking at, you know, keeping you comfortable, keeping you happy, keeping you preoccupied with something else in order to numb you from looking at what's actually happening in the world around you.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because here in BC, in the first round of lockdowns, like churches and everything were closed, but liquor stores were left open.
Mm-hmm.
But now...
Same here.
I'm pretty sure. And I'm not 100% sure on this, so please don't quote me and look it up for yourself, and I'll look it up after. But I'm fairly certain that with the vaccine passport coming to BC next week, that liquor stores are actually not included, and you're not allowed to go to a liquor store unless you've had your vaccine. But I honestly think it's because they know that people are going to get their vaccine in order to go and get their liquor. I really, truly believe that mm-hmm. because people need their alcohol. And this is not, I also think we see the use of alcohol on social media a lot. And particularly, I'm thinking of mom culture right now. And I am not saying that moms shouldn't like wine, but I do think it's become this thing, like a joke, almost like, oh, mommy needs wine. And yeah. that's where I have a bit of a problem with
it. Yeah.
It's like, ooh, I'm all for you enjoying a glass of wine. But should you be drinking it if you need to numb yourself from what's going on in your home? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's like, not a healthy thing.
And I definitely don't want anybody to take this as judgment, because I enjoy a glass of wine. Absolutely yeah. do. Not right now, obviously. But but like you said, it's the need mm-hmm. word put in front of it, and
yeah.
rather than just in making it this thing in your life. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
Elevating it. And then the way it's being used right now, you know, from the top-down approach, like you said, we don't even realize that it's being promoted in this way often for a purpose, like you said, back to the elites and innocence. So
mm-hmm. for sure.
And like another thing with that, like the phone issue. So I was thinking of that, like all kind of stories cropped up in my head today from the last year, just thinking through how this is all working and playing out. Last July, we were over to friends and the adults were kind of sitting around discussing. And one of the, and since I work in an ICU, you know, they were asking me a lot of, you know, what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the dads was like, I completely agree. And he was like, I just think people cannot break themselves away from the news and from, you know, looking at this stuff constantly. And they can't just like look around them and see what's actually going on around them. And meanwhile, I look over and his child is been sitting on a smartphone while we're like sitting around talking and the rest of the kids are playing outside. His kid's been sitting on a smartphone for like 45 minutes playing games. Yeah. And this is the other piece of this. We can see what's happening around us. That's mm-hmm. great. But if you don't see what's happening around you and then do something about it and try to understand what's happening and make that change in your own lives for your next generation, what's the point of even seeing what's going on? You know, I don't know. That's really frustrating to me because you can't complain about something if you're not willing to do something.
That's right. And that's part of the problem, right? Like people are seeing problems, but perpetuating the problem by not changing it. So I was looking, I'm glad you brought up the screen thing because I was looking last night. I was thinking, you know, the future is our children. And if we have a hard time as adults tearing ourselves away from this culture that has become all about entertainment, whether it's politics or news or healthcare or whatever, everything has become some form of hold your attention, entertainment. What is it doing to our children? So I looked up on the CDC website that children ages 8 to 10 spend about 6 hours a day in front of the screen, and about 4 of those are watching TV. Youths age 11 to 14 spend about 9 hours a day. 9 hours a day. That's more than a job, like in front of a screen using entertainment media. And 5 of those are usually spent watching TV. And then children or teens, I guess, age 15 to 18 spend about 7.5 hours a day in front of a screen. And about 4.5 of those are spent watching TV. Like these kids are basically working a full-time job watching television or playing on phones or tablets.
So where's the family time in there? That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's not only the fact that they have this constant internal craving for entertainment. Mm-hmm. That is part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is there's, if that's what you're spending your time on, there's only mm-hmm. so many hours of in a day, and there's no time for family conversation in the rearing of your children if that's what they're constantly strapped to.
Yeah.
And that makes me think about how do you hear this? I don't know. I hear this a lot, but that families can't make it these days with only one parent working. Do you hear that often? I mean, I hear people say that a lot, and I think about it, and I think, yeah, it is hard if you do want all the things that the world has to offer, if you want all the latest gadgets, and that's where you put your value, I guess.
Yeah.
But – and I'm not saying anything wrong with two-parent working homes, but I think that – and we've talked about this before. We're just distracted with lifestyle a lot. And I think that as comforts increase, our time because of the time we spend working to be able to buy and provide those comforts, our time together decreases. And then our thought about the world around us decreases because we're spending all of our time thinking about, you know, getting the next best thing, and our time raising up the next generation also decreases.
Yeah.
And it's 100%. Replaced with that technology that you just talked about and offering that to our kids as entertainment instead of our conversations and time rearing them up.
Yeah. And this is not meant to like make people feel guilty or anything. Like
make us think. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And like Reed and I both have worked outside the home, and I am again, like it's just, but you need to make sure that your priorities stay where they should and that your values are always driving what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. And if it starts to look like that family time is slipping, or you're turning into a horribly cranky person because you have no time, or if it looks like you're using that extra income on things that are just adding to waste and to indulgence or gluttony, then that's not a good thing. Like, I know for a fact that my family can survive on just my husband's income because we did that for a long time. And he's a teacher. Like, he doesn't have a super high paying job. But because of the fact that we did that for a while, I know we can. And that any income that I bring in is extra. And it's our intention to not use that for purposes that are going to take away from family or increase gluttony or consumption.
Yeah. And like you said, this is not a judgment call for us to make upon you. It's more of just being aware, because it's so easy, guys. Like, I know in my own life, it is so easy for me to be consumed with something.
Oh, yes.
And you just have to be purposeful. You have to be so on top of where your mind's at, and if you're actually like applying your daily life to your values and your values to your daily life, and vice versa, because it's so easy, especially in this fast-paced, distracted society that Huxley described, you know, to detach yourself from what's really important.
Yeah. And like we say so often, it always starts with something good, right? Like, you detach from some important things for a little while because you're doing something else that's worthy and good and important.
Yeah.
But we need to be able to reassess constantly. There's been so many times where I've been taken down a path that I shouldn't be going down because of the fact that it starts out as something good that I feel like is a good cause, but then it just takes away from things that should be my ultimate priorities.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. Well, and you know, if you want to go back to the Orwell or Huxley novels, or even we had mentioned The Giver a while back, all of these dystopian or utopian, whichever way you want to look at it, novels and projections of what could happen in society, or projections of what could happen if you strive for that utopian society, really center around something, quote, good in the beginning, right? They center around safety pretty much, right? Well, and that's what's happening in our world right now is a mind, you know, an agenda centered around safety and promoted out as safety, so people will willingly accept, and we're being sold that safety model and needs provided by someone else, you know. And it's kind of all just centered around that, right?
Totally. I think. And yeah, in a commentary that I read on Huxley's book, Brave New World, it said that community, identity, and stability are considered to be the main values in the world state, and the regime has succeeded very well in realizing them. And so as I read that paragraph and that commentary, I was like, that is so interesting, because I would say that that is what we're prizing right now as well. So the three things, again, that they said was community, identity, and stability. So right now, guys, I'm sorry, I'm bringing it back to COVID again, but when we think of community, we're being told that you prize the community and that you are a good and worthy community member if you get the vaccine. Whether or not that makes logical sense is not what I'm talking about right now, but that is what that's what we're being told as a culture, that you are a good community member and you prize community if you are willing to get that vaccine. And that if you're not, you are a bad community member. You don't care about the person next to you. Okay, so that's the first one, community. The second one is identity. And identity has become, I mean, identity is important, but it has become something else entirely. Like, it has become a gender issue. It has become a self-love issue. And people's identities are being elevated to a point that's very anti-biblical. And I understand that not everyone has a Christian worldview and not everyone finds their identity in Christ, but the search for personal identity and fulfillment has become incredibly damaging to our society, I believe. Okay, so that's two things, community and identity. The third thing prized in Brave New World is stability. And that's exactly what Rita was just saying. We're prizing stability and safety above all. Basically, we're prizing the continuation of life, even if that means we're not really living. So I just found that really interesting. Community, identity, and stability is what drove the world state in Brave New World. And I just really see that we are prizing those same things in our world.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that excerpt, she read this to me on Voxer too yesterday, and I was like, whoa, that's what we're living in right now. It's just, it's so interesting. And then they kind of, I don't want to say trick you, but into living within this, you know, quote, safe community and having your needs provided for, it's, man, it's just all such a web and mess right now. I was thinking about the needs provided being, you know, via these stimulus checks we've been given out and these massive, massive bills that have been written for stimulus and these child stimulus checks that they're sending out once a month now in the US. And it's just also very interesting how the will towards safety has kind of destroyed our way of life as we know it. So now our needs are provided by this government. And how do you get out of that cycle? And so, like the Huxley portion of what he's talking about, the safety portion, has led to the Orwellian portion of the government providing and controlling. And it's so intertwined. And it's just so interesting how they're both right.
It really is. I don't know. I just find it's like, I'm such a nerd, but I just find it so.
No.
I really am. I know.
Like we both are. This was like such a great topic to research and dive into. And I hope you guys are enjoying this, like talking through this. And I really hope you guys will read through some of these links because it's just so interesting to think about.
Yeah. Or you'll read through them and be like, you guys are nerds. You guys are crazy. But like, I almost get giddy over stuff like this. I'm like, ooh. It's kind of like makes you feel uncomfortable because you see this dystopian stuff actually happening. But on the other hand, it's like, this is so interesting. It's so, so cool. But I don't know. That might just be.
Also, the biodigital episode we did, this ties in so well with that. Yeah. If you did not listen to the episode, guys, like you have got to know about the biodigital.
Oh, yes.
Like it's huge. Research it. It's on the government websites. It's huge. But that's also like those. So Cecily read some examples in that biodigital episode of what the government of Canada, and then what the World Economic Forum is projecting as the way we live.
And they're actually describing it as like a utopia.
Within this biodigital sphere. And it's described as a utopia, and it's the comfort and safety again being brought in by way of monitoring. So again, it is both sides of this dystopian, you know, these dystopian novels coming together and merging together to make this safe society. And it's just wild.
Yeah, it is. So definitely have a listen to that. And like what Rita and I have said often on this podcast is we need challenge in life. We need that as part of our refinement process. So utopia should not be found on Earth.
No.
Like, no, it just shouldn't, because we wouldn't be doing ourselves any favors.
I had looked up a scripture from James. Are you okay if I read that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so James 1, and I'm going to start at verse 2 and read to verse 11. So consider it a great joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you experience various trials, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its full effect, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. Now, if any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives all generously and ungrudgingly, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith without doubting, for the doubter is like the surging sea, driven and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord, being double-minded and unstable in all ways. Let the brother of humble circumstances boast in his exaltation, but let the rich boast in his humiliation, because he will pass away like a flower of the field. It was like, it was dashed in my book as flow and then so excuse me, guys.
That's hilarious.
For the sun rises and together with the scorching wind dries up the grass and its flower falls off and its beautiful appearance perishes. In the same way, the rich person will wither away while pursuing his activities. So I just thought, especially that last line, it's not about riches or, you know, it's not about the haves and have nots. That's not what this is about. It's about what you're pursuing.
Yes.
That's the point driven home. So what are we pursuing? And are we being consumed in that pursuit away from the things that matter? And are we being distracted from seeing the evils of the world and being aware of it you know, in those pursuits.
Oh, so good. And that's what I was going to say, is that we have a choice, guys. Like, we know because of our last couple episodes that there's an elites and there's an innocence, and that a lot of this is being pushed from the elites. But the thing is, we have a choice as mm-hmm. people that live in the world about what direction we want to take. And we don't want to take Orwell's path, and we don't want to take Huxley's path. And, or just to be fair, Orwell and Huxley didn't want that either. These were ideas they had of the future.
It was a warning, essentially.
It was a warning. Yeah. But we get to choose. We can say no to those things. And I know that we're just individuals, but when individuals band together and say that's not the direction we want to go, that's what we can do. So that means, like, the way we live, the way we vote, all of those things. And so I love that passage from James. And then I have one here from Jeremiah. This is part of a letter that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles in Babylon. It says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare." So I just think that's a really important thing. We may not be exiled into Babylon, but Babylon bears a lot of similarities to the culture we find ourselves in. And I just think that we can worry and we can fret, or we can live our lives, right? We can live our lives. Mm-hmm. We can build houses and live in them. We can plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and have sons and daughters. Like, we can continue to multiply and not decrease. And importantly, we can seek the welfare of the city where we are and pray to the Lord, because like it said, for in its welfare, you will find your welfare. And that doesn't mean just going with the flow. That means being intentional and proactive in the life choices that we make.
Yes, intentional. That's a huge word. Just because then we're aware of what we're doing, instead of just buying into all of this and floating about, you know.
Yeah, Rita,
we're planted and rooted.
What's that saying that your dad used to say, like,
Only
dead fish, something like that.
Yeah, he said it a few different ways, but only dead fish float with the current, essentially, was how he phrased it. But he was saying, like, don't be a dead fish. Don't just float along in the stream. You know, it takes effort to swim against the current. It's not easy. It's, you know, building a muscle.
Yeah.
But it's better that way, because you're not a dead fish.
I don't want to be a dead fish. Those things stink.
No.
Anyway.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening. I hope that you do take time to look up these two men a little bit, and just their thought processes, because Cecily and I both can see it very equally distributed, their thought processes playing out in the world. And I hope after hearing this, you guys can too, and just being aware of it and being actively living our lives in a way that's not promoting that is so important. So, thanks for listening. You can find me, Rita, at RitaRogersCo.com or RitaRogersCo on Instagram.
And you can find me, Cecily, on Instagram at Cecily.Dickey or on my website, thegracetogrow.com.